Hi, listeners and fellow adventurers. This is Living in the Sprawl's lovely and talented fiancé/producer, Lisa Lowe, here to tell you about Every Table. My days typically start at 4 a.m. to exercise, work a full day, cook, clean, and work on this podcast, all while trying to get to bed by 9 p.m. Like many of you, there aren't always enough hours in the day to do it all, so I do rely on food delivery that requires little to no prep, is healthy, cost-effective, and most importantly, delicious. Every Table is offering our listeners 2 free meals and free delivery when you use the code SPRAWL, SPRAWL, on your first subscription order. I will put the link in the show notes and on our website at livinginthesprawlpodcast.com. And now, your humble correspondent and this week's episode.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of Living in the Sprawl, Southern California's most adventurous podcast. My name is John Steinberg, your humble correspondent and host, sitting alongside my lovely and talented producer slash fiance, Miss Lisa Lowe, and we are set to bring you an episode delving into the phenomenal musical tradition brought to you by Southern California. So today we have our top 10 Southern California musicians who best exemplify the quote unquote California sound. For this list, I wanted to focus on artists who either grew up in Southern California or spent the overwhelming majority of their time in the area. Not artists who held second homes or who came to record here, because obviously that would make the list not even necessarily a list. That would just make it all of the musicians of the past 75 years. So this leaves out your Frank Sinatra, your Michael Jackson, Madonna, etc., etc., etc. In order to be considered for inclusion on today's episode, the artist in question must have some certifiable roots which have been set down within the bounds of Southern California. And I wanted today's episode to include areas outside of Los Angeles. I hate it when the podcast begins to feel too Los Angeles-centric. So anticipate a part two. The 10 artists that I came up with do represent a fairly wide array of songwriting, musical stylings, traditions, and most importantly, geographic region. So this is not meant to be a comprehensive, who are the most famous individuals to have ever recorded in Southern California? Rather, a survey of sorts of the 10 musicians or groups that, when combined together, do have the ability to establish a quote-unquote California sound. And there are some omissions, because certain artists will be included on episodes delving into other aspects of this great, massive, indisputable sprawl where we currently reside. Let's begin. Number 10, Queens of the Stone Age. Now, I know what you're thinking. Queens of the Stone Age? But there have been hundreds and hundreds of bands that have come out of the area. True. But I'm including Queens of the Stone Age because they exemplify the desert sound. And this isn't something that I've created out of whole cloth. The desert sound is a verifiable thing, a musical movement of sorts, an armada of artists hailing largely from Palm Desert and the Coachella Valley, the high desert region, writ large, if you will. Part and parcel of this cohort includes artists such as Eagles of Death Metal, Fu Manchu, but most notably Queens of the Stone Age and their frontman, Josh Homme. For those of you who were fans of the late Anthony Bourdain, you might have seen the highly influential chef slash traveling expert touring the high desert with the Queens of the Stone Age frontman as his companion. Josh Homme brought him to the Salton Sea, which we covered on another recent episode of Living in the Sprawl, as well as Patty and Harriet's, an old school cowboy-esque restaurant in Pioneertown. And Homme took Bourdain to his famed recording studio, where Queens of the Stone Age have recorded the majority of their records, and a number of other artists have had occasion to set down some tracks as well. So Queens began as an offshoot of a fairly successful band called Caius. So it's a number of their members who reformed with some additional gentlemen from the high desert. And the group recorded their first album in 1998, self-titled. This was followed by the greatly successful sophomore offering, Rated R, which had the iconic feel-good hit of the summer and the lost art of keeping a secret. For those of you who don't instantly recognize the group's songs by their title, Feel Good Hit of the Summer is the one that goes nicotine, Valium, Vicodin, marijuana, ecstasy, alcohol, cocaine. It's that one. And they definitely began to build a name for themselves after the release of Rated R. And the group, I think, really hit their apex in 2002 when Songs for the Deaf was released with You Think I Ain't Worth a Dollar, But I'm a Millionaire. That was featured in the classic Vin Diesel action flick Triple X. Josh Homme and co-vocalist Nick Oliveri had their differences. There was a parting of the ways, but the group still managed to churn out one successful record after another, Lullabies to Paralyze being the highest chart topper. But I wanted to give them some love because of the desert sound thing. Some refer to it as stoner rock, and I like to think of it as what Jim Morrison might have come up with if you had given him unlimited time, a cell phone, and access to the internet. This is rock music that obviously has its roots in the vast open terrain afforded by living in the high desert. When you're out there in 29 Palms, around Joshua Tree, Palm Springs, the Coachella Valley, the world seems like it could go on forever. And sometimes these songs do too. But Queens of the Stone Age definitely exemplify a certain kind of Southern California artist. And that's why they're included here on Living in the Sprawls, 10 musicians that exemplify the California sound. Switching gears a bit for number 9, Jenny Rivera, who passed away in a tragic plane crash in 2012, but during her lifetime enjoyed a great deal of success specializing in regional Tejano music. From Long Beach, California, Rivera was the daughter of Mexican immigrants who wanted to provide their children with opportunities for a better life. The family spoke English and Spanish in the household. Jenny Rivera was fluent in both, and she developed an interest in music as a young girl, but she wasn't sure where her life was going to go when she found herself pregnant at the age of 15. But after giving birth to her first child, she did go on to obtain her GED. And it was a bit later that she got truly serious about music. In her lifetime, she was the recipient of numerous accolades. She sold millions of records and was the mother of five wonderful children. At the time of her death, she was actually married to former Major League Baseball pitcher Esteban Loaiza, and her family's compound was located in the hills of Encino, not all that far from where this podcast is being recorded today. Now, Rivera flew in the face of conventional notions of what a female Latin artist could achieve. There were a number of folks that objected to a woman pursuing the banda musical tradition. This had been a previously male-oriented subgenre, but Rivera found tremendous success, reaching tens of millions of listeners all across the globe. And when she passed away in December of 2012, the world lost yet another wonderful young Mexican-American songstress, as had been the case with the unfortunate passing of Selena 15 or so years prior to that. So Southern California is a richly diverse cross-section of humanity, and much of the area's historical roots are based in Mexican traditions. So I thought Jenny Rivera absolutely deserved inclusion on a list like this, and this is why she appears at number 9. And number 8, Blink-182 from San Diego, California. Lead vocalist Mark Hoppus was actually from the East Coast originally, but after he moved out along with his family in his late teens, he met Poway native Tom DeLonge, and the two bonded over a shared adoration for classic punk music, Your Bad Religion, Agent Orange, X, Minor Threat. And though Blink's musical output would veer largely in a pop-oriented direction, the group initially started out deeply committed to their punk roots. Their first album, Buddha, which contained some early demo versions of songs that would later appear on Cheshire Cat, sounds wholly different from some of the records that would turn them into global rock superstars a bit later in their career. Interesting anecdote, as a teenager myself, I was at the local mall with a good friend at Sam Goody, so that tells you how long ago this was. I bought a Rage Against the Machine CD, and Mark Hoppus was standing behind me. So I asked him for an autograph, and he looked at my CD, The Battle of Los Angeles, ironically, and said, "Wow, those guys are pissed off." And yeah, he signed a piece of paper for me. In any event, Blink-182, who enjoyed their greatest bout of success with Enema of the State, coasted a wave of pop punk all the way to superstardom, appearing as themselves, question mark, in the background of a scene in American Pie and headlining festivals in every corner of the globe. Travis Barker, who joined the band after Dude Ranch catapulted them into the larger musical consciousness, brought a whole new level of fame to the group with his irrefutable penchant for drum solos and beats that propelled their three-chord rock anthems into a different dimension. As the members of the group aged, the tenor of their music changed a bit with songs like I Miss You, Stay Together for the Kids, really seeing Hoppus, DeLong, and Barker as they aged and began families of their own. Unfortunately, as is so often the case, there was a parting of the ways, and Tom DeLong separated from the group in order to start. Actually, sidetrack here. What Tom DeLong did in the wake of his exit from Blink-182 is really worthy of an entire podcast unto itself. For those of you unaware, listen to episode 1029 of the Joe Rogan Experience, where DeLong comes on and expresses his views on UFOs and discusses in length this academy he started called To the Stars, which, you know what, I will allow you to do some Googling and listening for yourselves. Suffice to say, the guy who sang All the Small Things wound up being one of the country's foremost alien experts. Very interesting turn of events. The group reformulated again after DeLong's departure and have since recorded a couple of albums and toured extensively. I got to see him a couple years ago with the new lineup, and listening to someone other than Tom DeLong sing All the Small Things was a little bit unnerving, I don't mind saying. But because of the massive success the group enjoyed and their ability to take a classical punk sensibility and translate it for a mainstream MTV audience, I think they deserve their spot on this list at number 8. I could have included Buck Owens here, a couple of other country-oriented artists, but Merle Haggard exemplifies a certain kind of Southern California resident, and in turn, the music that that resident probably listens to. So the Okie from Muskogee, who spent time behind bars in San Quentin before realizing his dream of becoming a country western artist, told his audience in very direct terms where he stood. He sang again for that certain kind of Southern California resident, the one who doesn't smoke marijuana, the one who doesn't have long hair and open embrace of true love. Okie from Muskogee flies in the face of everything the 1960s, 1970s, and early 1980s espoused about how to dress, how to view the world, how to view politics. Merle Haggard was holding it down for a whole crop of citizens who wanted nothing to do with the weed smoke and bell bottoms. He's actually from Oildale, a smaller area right outside of Bakersfield, but along with Buck Owens, the two gentlemen pioneered the quote-unquote Bakersfield sound. Again, as was the case with the desert sound, this is not something that I'm creating, rather a musical tradition that has a certifiable history and horde of fans who've been supporting it for quite some time. Haggard took the overall vision for what a country song could be, was supposed to be, from artists like Hank Williams and Patsy Cline, and added a twang from the Central Valley to it, creating his own brand of country music. For those of you who haven't had the opportunity to watch the Ken Burns country music documentary series. I highly recommend it. There's an entire episode dedicated to Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, and the like. And more than anything, the documentary, as is the case with all Ken Burns documentaries, does a phenomenal job of truly weeding through the history of a subject in order to get to the good stuff. For anyone who loves Mama Tried and all of the other hits, and there were dozens of them that Merle Haggard brought to the world, we salute him here. I know he passed away a couple years ago at number 7. Number 6, we must believe that we are indeed well qualified to represent the LBC as we talk to you about Sublime. Not Sublime with Rome, not the Long Beach Dub All-Stars, but the original formation of Sublime. The group formed in the early 90s with all the members from the Long Beach area. Lead vocalist and guitarist Bradley Knoll was from the Belmont Shores area, and the bandmates met while studying at Cal State Long Beach. I found it interesting when I read that Bradley Knoll's father took him on an excursion as a child to the Caribbean. And it was during this trip that Knoll found a passion for reggae music. And it was this passion blended with the punk alternative music that was flowing out of places like the South Bay and Greater Los Angeles in the 80s and the 90s that gave birth to the hybrid that Sublime truly were on their 3 studio albums. Tragically, just as the band reached global superstardom, frontman Bradley Knoll succumbed to a long battle with heroin addiction in a hotel room in the San Francisco area. He had just gotten married. He had also just became a father for the first time, and he was only 28 years of age when he passed away. And after Knoll's passing, the other members of the band could not in good conscience carry on touring as Sublime. Sublime with Rome, that came more than a decade later, and depending on where you stand, achieved varying levels of critical success. When I think about Sublime, my mind automatically goes to Bradley Knoll's Dalmatian in the music video for What I Got, and the group citing different American cities by name as potential havens for rioting in their iconic encapsulation of the 92 riots, April 29th, 1992. Even though Knoll begins the song by stating an incorrect date, he says April 26th, 1992. And of course, it was April 29th, 1992. Date rape, Santeria, Bad Fish, Pawn Shop, Doing Time, Summertime. The hits go on and on. And the influence of Sublime can be seen in bands like Pepper, Revolution, Slightly Stupid. There have been a ton of imitators, but there was only one original. The gentlemen who were best qualified to represent the LBC. We pour 40 ounces to the ground as we remember Sublime. And number 5, Katy Perry. Before she warmed the world's heart as a certifiable pop princess, she was chopping it up as both a Christian gospel singer and then a wannabe punk goddess. Born Catherine Hudson, Katy Perry is a Santa Barbara girl who grew up in a deeply religious home. Her parents were both extremely active in their local ministry. I found this interesting. As a girl, Perry's mother insisted that her children refer to deviled eggs as angel eggs. Now, I don't want to make too much of a specific anecdote. However, I think this is one of those situations where we can extrapolate a little bit from that story. If you grow up in a household where your parents are changing the names of food because they don't align with their religious beliefs, then we can kind of gather what environment you probably grew up in. And it was with this deeply held religious conviction that the young songstress began her musical career, as I mentioned, singing in the classical Christian tradition at the start of her career under the name Katie Hudson. It wasn't until changing her name to Katy Perry, just using her middle name and chopping off her last name, moving from Santa Barbara to Los Angeles, that she really began to gain some traction in the industry. After two failed stints with different record labels, Perry signed with Capitol and solicited assistance from noted producers Max Martin and Dr. Luke to really help her to find that certain pop sensibility. It was with the help of Dr. Luke that she recorded her two biggest songs to that moment in time, which were Hot and Cold and I Kissed a Girl. And suddenly, Katy Perry was no longer playing during the daytime on the side stage at the Warped Tour, but rather competing for airtime on radio stations like Kiss 102.7. And it was in 2010, upon the release of Teenage Dream, that global superstardom and Katy Perry united as one. There have been a number of successful pop stars to come out of the Southern California area in the last 6, 7, 8 decades. But Katy Perry personifies California in a number of different ways. When I think about the song California Girls and the vibe that she casts out, it does make me think, wow, if I were from another state and I'd never been to California, I would wonder, do a number of the women there act like this? So when California girls were undeniable, bathing suits, bikinis on top, she was singing to an ideal of the quote-unquote California woman, the girl that the Beach Boys used to croon about and tourists have flocked to the area in search of. When she performed at the Super Bowl halftime show in 2015, Perry was at the absolute zenith of pop stardom. I had the pleasure of running into her before she became incredibly famous in line, well, actually in the TSA line at LAX. I didn't recognize her. My sister did. She was very nice, took a picture with us, and she was really sweet to my younger sister. So it's a personal anecdote attesting to her being a very nice person. As her career has gone on a bit longer, some of the success which she enjoyed upon the release of Teenage Dream hasn't been as easy to find. Prism and Smile haven't had the number one chart toppers the way that Teenage Dream or One of the Boys did. But Katy Perry's appearance as a judge on American Idol, her aforementioned Super Bowl halftime show stint, and the stranglehold she really seemed to possess for several years, I felt, made her wholly deserving of a spot on Living in the Sprawl's list of musicians that best exemplify the California sound. At number four, Van Halen, a group that I had no idea were from Southern California, let alone America's grandest suburb, Pasadena. If you'd given me 175 guesses, I would have never imagined that Eddie and Alex Van Halen, as well as David Lee Roth, all met while playing in different bands in Pasadena. And yet, that's exactly what happened. The Van Halen family emigrated from the Netherlands when Eddie was 7 and his brother Alex was a couple years older. They found themselves outcasts at their local elementary school. They spoke Dutch. English was difficult for the Van Halen boys, and they turned to music as something of an outlet as they sought acceptance and ways to connect with their surroundings. David Lee Roth, originally from the East Coast, was the son of a wealthy ophthalmologist, and the family relocated to the West Coast when Diamond Dave was but a youngster. Lee Roth and the Van Halen boys went to separate high schools. The Van Halens started in a band called Mammoth that gained a lot of local support, playing parties on weekends in Pasadena and surrounding areas. And David Lee Roth wanted in. He was able to see the obvious talent on display with the Van Halen brothers. And when the two united forces, a musical superpower was unleashed upon the world. Eddie Van Halen, one of the greatest guitarists in the history of rock music, skinned his musical teeth playing in the backyards of classmates and fellow Pasadena residents. And again, I cannot emphasize how odd it is that the guy who played the unforgettable guitar solo on Eruption is from a place like Pasadena. Sometimes the greatest things come from the most unexpected places, shall we say. And David Lee Roth, too, for that matter. These gentlemen seem like they would have been from Glendora, I suppose, which is actually where Tommy Lee and Vince Neil are from Motley Crue. But when Eddie Van Halen passed away, a makeshift memorial was established outside the residence where his family had grown up. And there's a great article in the LA Times that was published in the wake of his passing that delves into the Pasadena roots of both Van Halen brothers and David Lee Roth. So, surprisingly but wonderfully, we recognize the greatness of Pasadena's Van Halen. At last, we get to number three, saluting Etta James. Born Jamesetta Hawkins in South Los Angeles, the all-world rhythm and blues pioneer, got her first start in music singing at the local church in South Los Angeles, and she spent time in different parts of that region, Watts, Inglewood, where it became readily apparent to anyone who had the great fortune of listening to her that the young Jamesetta Hawkins had a natural gift for singing. After relocating for a bit to the northern part of the state, Hawkins found success recording for Leonard Chess of Chess Records, as was dramatized in the 2008 film Cadillac Records. You know, if Beyonce is playing you in a film, you've done something right. And I would urge anybody that hasn't seen that movie to check in with it. The history isn't the greatest. However, the Beyonce performance is spectacular. If you've ever wondered what Beyoncé might be like if she had several cocktails in her, Cadillac Records offers you a shortcut answer to that very question. But Etta James reached the pinnacle of musical appreciation when she covered At Last, which had originally been written for Glenn Miller in 1942. But when Etta James sang those two simple words, At Last, everyone took notice. And that song will be played at weddings in perpetuity. But it wasn't merely her cover of At Last that propelled Etta James to global icon status. Hits such as The Wallflower, I'd Rather Be Blind, and Tell Mama also cemented her status as one of music's undeniable R&B divas. And I use diva in a positive manner in that instance. If you're a diva, that means people care enough to grant you that label. Ashley Simpson is not a diva. Artists that have only had a couple of hits, those are not divas. Divas are women whose legacy will stand the test of time. Etta James did battle drug and substance abuse problems throughout the course of her life. At multiple intervals, she was hospitalized in Tarzana, and she did pass away at the age of 74 in 2012. Beyoncé actually sang Etta James' version of At Last during the 2008 inauguration of Barack Obama. When asked about this, Etta James said that she admired the performance but wish she would have been the one to have sang the song herself. Etta James, At Last, you've achieved the success you always deserved. And that's why you're at number 3 on our list. Number 2, we've got to talk about the Beach Boys, don't we? They happened to come up in a recent episode of Living in the Sprawl in our discussion of the Hawthorne Plaza Mall as this group of surfing brothers grew up in the sleepy South Bay suburb of Hawthorne. Pet Sounds is one of the greatest records of all time, in my humble estimation. And Brian Wilson's evolution as a songwriter slash artist was one of the most fascinating developments in the history of rock and roll music. To go from Surfin' USA, and I Wish They All Could Be California Girls, to God Only Knows and Wouldn't It Be Nice, marks an enormous sea change in the life of an artist. And Brian Wilson defined what it meant to live in Southern California for a great number of residents. When I talk to my father, who grew up in West Los Angeles, he will mention the Beach Boys. He'll bring up the fact that he and his friends used to drive to the beach with the Beach Boys on in the background, and their music would be playing at bonfires or gatherings, and the Beach Boys were an absolute presence on the music scene, and their output still holds up, as God Only Knows was used in Boogie Nights, the show Big Love. Wouldn't It Be Nice has been in a ton of movies. I'm thinking about 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. And Brian Wilson's life was chronicled in Love and Mercy, with Paul Dano playing younger version of Wilson, writing and recording Pet Sounds, with John Cusack playing a more aged version of Wilson struggling with his mental health. The Beach Boys really do exemplify Southern California and would appear as the number one artist on this list if I didn't already have it earmarked for the individual or individuals who claimed the top spot here. but when contemplating the beach, a summer spent in the ocean, on a surfboard, or driving to said beach with said surfboard on top, a station wagon, the Beach Boys served as a kind of soundtrack for multiple generations of kids who came up in the area. And there's a deep reservoir of stories to accompany the music, both in and out of the studio. See Dennis Wilson and his involvement with the Manson family, Mike Love and his falling out with the other members of the group, and the Wilson brothers' relationship with their tyrannical father. All the classic makings of an American rock story, and it was birthed in the backyard of Southern California, in the sleepy suburb of Hawthorne, California. Number one on Living in the Sprawls list, Southern California artists that most exemplify the, quote, Southern California sound is none other than the doctor himself, Dr. Dre, of course. And I found out that he came up with the idea for the name because his favorite basketball player was Dr. J. Didn't know that before. And I've got to assume that Lakers fans wouldn't necessarily love hearing that. But the good doctor has blessed the world with an incomparable discography. And even though his musical output isn't limitless, it sometimes feels that way. From his start with NWA, to The Chronic, to his breakup with Death Row and formation of Aftermath, to The Resurrection, prompted by the release of 2001, Dr. Dre is, without question for me, the defining Southern California artist. Rap, hip-hop, whatever you want to call it, it's not going anywhere. It's going to be with us in some form or another for the rest of my lifetime and probably yours. And we can collectively thank the good doctor for his ability to popularize a form of niche music that hadn't yet connected with a vast, wide-ranging constituency. Not until NWA, and really not until The Chronic. When he belted out Nothing But a G-Thang and Let Me Ride, a whole nation, nay, a whole world, found themselves on board with rap music. So, as everyone, I'm sure, knows by now, Dr. Dre grew up in South Los Angeles, Compton, Carson, East Long Beach, and he actually attended the same high school that Kendrick Lamar would later attend, Compton Centennial, though he didn't graduate and he wound up transferring to a different school. But I find that serendipitous, that the two greatest rap artists of their respective generations would have both found themselves attending the same high school. Cannot script things like that. Whether it's his contribution to the wider listening game with the creation of Beats Music, or his work behind the scenes as a producer for artists like Eminem, 50 Cent and The Game, Dr. Dre is a one of one, a singular musical tsunami whose impact reverberated across the globe. I do want to emphasize that there are some omissions on this list, and as has been the case with prior episodes, I am doing topics such as this one with an eye toward a part two, but for this one, when I thought about it, there was no one who could claim the spot of the Southern California artist who best exemplifies the California sound like the good doctor, Dr. Dre. So that is where we will leave it for today. We want to thank you again for your continued support. We encourage you to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, 5 stars, a nice comment. Those kinds of things do serve as the lifeblood of podcasts. They help to drive you up the charts so that more people are exposed to the show. If you'd like to correspond with us, we invite you to write us at livinginthesprawlpodcast@gmail.com. Suggestions, comments, anything that you would like for us to know, we do encourage you to reach out to us. The Instagram handle is livinginthesprawlpodcast. And again, we want to thank all of you for your continued support. I mean my lovely co-host / producer / fiance, Lisa Lowe. We thank you very much for everything that you've done for us. And until next time, we hope to see all of you out there in the great wide world doing your absolute best to maximize living in the sprawl.